Welcome to today's show. This is What We Need to Know, and my name is Andrea Isaacs. I'm really excited to bring you today's guest. His name is Dario Nardi. He's the author of several books, and he's been doing some neuroscience research. And I first met him when he was a keynote speaker at an international Enneagram conference a year and a half ago. And then again, he and I were both presenters at a conference and another Enneagram conference in Madrid this last fall. Did you know that the gifts and strengths of who you are, the gifts of your personality, can actually be seen in your brain? Did you know that your brain has more and less developed parts of it? And did you know that the areas of your brain that are less developed can actually be strengthened, that can, in a way that you can actually strengthen those qualities within your personality? One of the reasons I'm so excited about today's show is Dario and I are embarking on a collaboration, a research project that will bring any emotion into his brain lab. And the idea is to start with a baseline, to see someone's brain, which parts of the brain are more or less developed. And for those of you who know personality systems, either the Enneagram or Myers-Briggs, we can see the relationship between your personality and your brain. And then we'll actually do some any emotion and somatic focusing, and we'll be talking more about what those terms are, and then take them back to the brain lab and find out what kind of change happened in the brain. And then that will conclude with an integrating session, integrating what we learned from the brain lab so that they can have some take-home tools that can actually give help to strengthen the parts of their brains that are less developed. So, Dario, I'm so excited to know you. I'm so excited about this project and just to let people know more about what we're up to. So thank you for being with me today. Welcome.
Oh, absolutely, Andrea. And I'm excited to be here. And, of course, this is, I think, a really exceptional opportunity, what you were talking about with trying out any emotion and somatic focusing and shifting our brain, because it's one thing to gain awareness about who we are. And there's a lot of tools out there that can help us do that. And neuroscience is I'm not going to say just, but it's taking us to a little bit more detailed level and more accuracy. To go beyond that, though, from awareness to action, that I think is what really is exciting. People want to know, what is it that I can improve about myself, or how can I more consciously shift my behavior? Those kinds of things is it feels like, you know, the whole field is opening up. There's so many possibilities these days, and it's the science makes it very exciting just in and of itself.
Well, you know, that is so true. Neuroscience seems to be one of the big topics these days. It seems to be a very popular topic, and it's interesting, not just in terms of seeing the brain and the scans and so on. But I like what you said. It's awareness to action. So now that I can see that's what my brain looks like, what can I do about it? And I'm so excited that the work that I've been developing and doing the last 20 years could be something that could help people change their brain.
Yeah, and that naturally people do wonder not only which regions of the brain are more or less active, and that's something that, you know, I've been looking at for the past 7 years as people come in, and I work with them hands-on for 2 or 3 hours. But beyond that, wanting to know if there are these, besides a primary pattern that they have, secondary patterns, can they consciously shift to those? And I think that certainly the tools like the ones you're using, well, we're going to find out just how much of an impact they have. But I have to say, it sounds like we are going to see some interesting results just based upon the experiences I have had so far in the lab.
So I know you've done a lot in the Myers-Briggs community, and that in the scans, do you call it a scan, the work that you do in the lab? Is that what you call it?
Well, you know, I haven't really quite settled on a term, which might seem rather funny after a number of years. I usually say it's a brain lab session. But you know, when I invite folks, it's sort of like a brain scan, but that might sound like it's a little bit passive or scary. And in fact, it's really an informal process. And, I mean, in terms of the environment and so on, yeah, they put on a little cap the whole time. And that takes a few minutes to get that all set up. But otherwise, people are just doing fun tasks. So they could be signing their name, doing math problems, listening to music, playing cards, talking in a foreign language. So really, it's more than just a scan. It's a whole variety of activity. So that's why I say it's sort of like a brain lab.
Right, because there's activity. You're not just lying there going through a tube or having you're just having images taken. So people, you put some kind of a pad on the head, and I want people to know we don't have to shave their heads, right?
Right. There's nothing elaborate like that. No, we do have two or three folks who are more difficult. If you're completely bald, that may present some challenges, although I've worked with one gentleman.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't so bad. Well, the hair actually helps keep in place the little elf-like cap, the Santa elf-like cap that they wear.
I thought being bald might give you a better contact.
Well, it could, but then the challenge is that the cap could slip around on your head as you're moving around a little bit, and which we all do, I mean, just to move your heads. Yeah.
Okay, so, well, one of our subjects is bald, so that'll be interesting.
Oh, okay. Well, he'll need, in my experience, it will pick up all the brain activity.
Yes.
We're just going to make the cap a little bit tighter, which means that once he's done it and takes off the cap, he's going to look like one of those Borg from Star Trek. With indentations all over his head.
Oh, but, that'll be interesting.
Yeah, those will go away in about 20 minutes.
Got it. Uh-huh. So then you have people do activities. It could be catching a ball or speaking in a foreign language or playing a piano. And you see when they're doing those activities, you track the time they did a certain activity with the time the brain activity did X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the one hand, we're administering the task to them and keeping track of when they start and stop each task. Mm-hmm. We also debrief the person after they do a task. So for example, if they do speed dating and they see or encounter a variety of dates and we ask them, you know, after that, you know, how did it go? What was going through your mind? We ask very broad, open-ended questions. In order to gain some insight and double-check results. Then at the same time, we're also seeing all this activity on the brain machine itself, and that's being recorded by the computer and analyzed during and especially afterwards. So there really can be a nice matchup between, say, activity and the interest level or engagement. And we also see these broad patterns, like which are their favorite regions of the brain in terms of use, which parts of the brain are well wired together so that they work in sync or in harmony. And so lots and lots of stuff to dig into, especially after 2 or 3 hours.
So I have a couple questions. You said something about you can tell which are the favorite regions of the brain in terms of use. Say more about, I know you've applied your research a lot to the Myers-Briggs world of personality. So I'm sure you've seen the, you know, inferior functions and the sensing and all the different functions in the brain. Could you talk about how people have favorite regions of the brain?
Sure, certainly. So it really, the favorites show up in three different ways. The first way is that simply that region is more active. Literally, actually, there's more electrical activity in that region than in a favorite region than in a non-favorite one. And that's one way it shows up. Another way is that we can look at which regions of the brain are working in sync or in harmony, how well they're connected.
And that's what you meant by being wired together?
Right, right. And that actually is very important because sometimes it's sort of like signing our name. You know, by the time we reach midlife, we're very good at certain things and they're favorites, but they don't take a lot of energy from the brain. So it's sort of important to differentiate between where we're putting a lot of effort on the one hand and where we actually have like good development and good wiring on the other. And that's so those are two. And then the third one is sort of these whole brain patterns, or what are called macro states. And that's when the brain is really working like I would say, we're not just looking at the individual instruments in the symphony. We're looking at the song that they're playing and how they all work together. And so those three, in many ways, correlate to people's personality preferences.
I know I've heard Daniel Siegel, who's done a lot of work. He's a psychiatrist, and he's done a lot of research with brain scientists. He has said, I'm sure he's not the first one that said it, you almost said it verbatim, that the neurons that fire together.
Yes.
Could you say what is meant by that statement?
Well, in the broadest sense, if we see, say, two or three different brain regions that fire together in sync constantly, and I'm talking about maybe once every second or two over hours, then that indicates they're really working together well. They're very well coordinated. But how are they coordinated? There has to be some kind of wiring, either directly from one region to the other, or maybe there's something underneath, like a deeper in the brain, that is causing them to fire together. So ultimately, it really is this wiring underneath. And the question is, how do we get wiring? Well, we get it through experience and practice and burning these neural pathways.
So what does that mean in terms of personality? Like if someone is, say, a very a generous person, every time they give someone a gift, for instance, or they give someone a compliment, there's the neurons that are firing in the brain are wiring together, meaning it makes a stronger neural pathway for them even being more generous? Or put that in terms of personality.
Right. So I would say, you know, the lot of people that I worked with at the beginning were university students, a traditional age around 18 to 24. And for the most part, their brain activity, their neural wiring, their personality, like those were all very much matched up. They were aligned with each other. So people were using, those young folks were using the parts of the brain that really matched with their personality. So as you described a sort of a behavior, but also some values like giving to others, giving back, paying attention to the feedback that people get. And certainly there's a part of the brain, sort of behind the ear, not under the ear, but behind it, more towards the back on the left side, for those of you who are right-handed. And that region of the brain helps us do things like, notice the facial expressions and signals, the social signals that other people give to us, and is also implicated in things like embarrassment and shame. So if somebody, we give them a gift and then they frown, well, immediately that part of the brain may get active. I say may because for people who have a preference, and this is fitting with their personality, that region gets active and it processes that information and says, oh gosh, I feel terrible. Did I do the wrong thing? And then other parts of the brain kick in and say, maybe I should do something different. But if something is out of personality, in other words, it's not part of the pattern of who they are, then maybe they won't even notice the person has frowned at them. Or they do, but they don't know what to do with that information. And so the behavior is not addressed. It doesn't get reinforced. And I would say it's very much the metaphor is like a farm field. And they say that you can imagine if it's just a flat area of desert and you don't really get any rain and there's no farming or anything, then the land remains flat. And then when it does rain, there's a flood. Firstly, for people who have a preference, a personality preference, as they start to use a region, these grooves form in it, sort of like when you do furrows when you're farming so that you have space for the seeds and you have channels for the water to go. And as those channels get used for farming, they actually get used more and more until eventually, well, you know, I suppose after millions of years, you get the Grand Canyon. And so a lot of personality seems like it's these reinforced activities over the first 20 years of our lives, and certainly could be more than that.
Yeah. And Dario has written several books. Two of them that are relevant in this context are 8 Keys to Self-Leadership, From Awareness to Action, and also The Neuroscience of Personality, Brain Savvy Insights for All Types of People. So a question I have is based on something you said about feedback. So there are some people who, for instance, will live to please others. They want to be, they want to satisfy other people's expectations of who they are, who they're supposed to be. And they don't listen to their own inner guidance as much as they try to do what's expected of them. And what you were just saying is there's something, this is the part behind the left ear, based on feedback. So if someone has a lot of concern about the feedback or lack of, that will affect their personality. It affects the brain, of course. And in your books, you talk about what people can do to develop parts of the brain that are less developed. So what would be a relationship between what you would see in the brain, the nature of that person, and what they might do to strengthen that part of the brain and develop that part of the personality?
Well, first of all, I want to say that for a lot of broad capabilities that we have, for example, things like empathy or logical reasoning, that those are not just in one area of the brain. They're in several different regions that support that.
Yeah.
So when we talk about something like EQ or EI, emotional intelligence, that really is sort of a suite of skills that are supported by various brain regions in the left hemisphere, in the right hemisphere, in the front, in the back. And so when we want to help somebody develop, one of the first things we'll do is we'll profile, well, how are you using those regions that are involved in, say, empathizing with others and using emotional intelligence? And so just that beginning of profiling will tell us where this person's strengths and weaknesses are and where those in-between spaces are. You know, the sort of the skills that are neither their favorites nor completely neglected. And for most people, you know, a good half of their brain is just going to be regions that they visit as needed every so often. They're neither favorites nor neglected. And those are really good candidates to develop further, to help the person locate situations in which that region becomes active, to look at neighboring regions right nearby. So if there's a neighbor who's very active, we'll say, hey, you've got this active neighbor. You know, we can engage the active neighbor and then there'll be some sort of a spillover effect. And really, even when we talk about brain regions, that each one of those regions is involved in 3, 4, 5 different things. And inevitably, people are going to be good at 1 or 2 out of the 5. And so the trick is if we can sort of use those 1 or 2 as to get in the door. And once we're in the door, then we can work a little bit further on that whole region, give them some activities that will help boost it up. And that's so there are a variety of ways to develop skills.
I love that image, to get in the door of that region. And once you're in the door, then you have access to other parts of that region to develop them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So if you want, I can give a little example of
Please.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a region that really is very much involved in what we might call emotional intelligence is this region on the right side of the brain behind or underneath the right ear. And for those of us who are right-handed, it's if you're left-handed, it's the reverse often. So what does this region do? Well, one of the obvious things it does is it helps us notice and remember melodies and to recall melodies, to sing a tune maybe that you know, we sort of recall somewhere. And that's all great. And that's, you know, we get exposure to that through most of our lives because music is a part of our culture. Another thing that region does is it helps us attend to tone of voice. And tone of voice and melody are actually quite related. I mean, not just conceptually, but handled by the same part of the brain. So if we want to help somebody develop some of their listening skills, one way we might begin is by helping them consider tone of voice. And because music is already a part of that, we might even introduce them, if they're really, really sort of, as we say, deaf to tone of voice, get them to listen to music first and to distinguish what are some of the emotions in the music. And move then to tone of voice, because the third thing that region does is it helps us sort out what are a person's intentions. In other words, what does the tone of voice suggest? If I say I'm really angry at you, okay, then there's a congruence there. You know, we don't even need to read between the lines. Right. But, you know, I could just be equally as sarcastic and say something that sounds good.
You might say, I'm not angry at you.
Right, or exactly that as well.
Yeah.
But by the way, we hear very quickly that part of the brain can hear that there's this incongruence. Yeah. And then that region is also implicated in managing feelings of hostility. And let's be honest, many of us have a challenge in dealing with times in our lives. Might even be on a daily basis. I know for me, it's when I see a parking enforcement person in my urban neighborhood. That there's this little, you know, I get the heart goes a little bit faster. I get a little bit irritated, and you know what? Well, it all makes sense evolutionarily, because when we hear a tone of voice that's phony or that's hostile or critical, naturally one of our very first reactions is to be angry and or defensive. And then we look at the neighboring regions around this one and we say they relate to things like personal identity and evaluation of ethics. So we understand then that anger, which is, you know, part of our suite of not only emotional reactions, but part of our emotional intelligence, now we begin to understand why the anger gets aroused. And just helping a person know when it gets aroused because of tone of voice, they detected something. So if somebody comes along and says, oh, I'm really angry, and if you say to them back, oh, don't be angry, okay, that's not going to work, folks.
No, yeah, I know that.
Right, that doesn't work.
Right.
So the knowledge of the brain has really helped me see that if a person is angry, there are 4 or 5 very likely reasons why. And the trick is to just sort of quickly identify which one of those, and actually can diffuse that very quickly. And for a person themselves, when they get angry, to just even briefly consider why, from what we know about the brain function, the brain anatomy, then gives them the opportunity to stop, to reflect, and then build the neural pathways that actually connect the self-reflective parts of us mm-hmm. with just the automatic responses.
Are you saying there are four reasons why someone's angry in terms of the brain? Or are there predictable reasons why people get angry?
Yeah, absolutely. So,
what are those four reasons that...
Okay. It's the person has said something where the tone of voice does not match. That it's indicating either it's phony or it's critical or whatever it is. Uh-huh. Or they have said or done something that violates our values and personal identity, which are very strongly tied to each other. And that region is right next door as a neighbor. A third reason, which is also a neighbor, is an ethics violation. So that isn't necessarily related to our values. That's actually a separate region of the brain that's involved in evaluating ethics in situations. And then another reason could be a violation of personal space. So in other words, if somebody gets too close to you physically or inconveniences you physically, that also is a neighbor right there in the brain. And so right away, I would think, well, which one of those is it going to be? And then there's like maybe a fifth one, which is really more about when people have their default responses, like, oh, somebody insulted me, but I'll ignore it. But we can only ignore so much. So
right.
It might be that that region of the brain has just become a little bit overwhelmed. Really, when it comes down to it, it's just knowing those few things then helps people understand, why do I react to this way? And I really have used this knowledge in practical situations.
Yes.
And been able to diffuse the hostile reaction simply by identifying, oh, this is what's going on. Not in an analytical way, but, you know, applying the idea to the situation.
Got it. Yeah, I've often said that anger is one of the most misunderstood, maybe even the most misunderstood emotion, because it's a secondary emotion. It happens because you've either been hurt or betrayed or... Mm-hmm. And it's the problem with anger is not the anger itself, but how people express it.
Mm-hmm.
They often either over express it, they get really angry back, or they under express it. They hold it in, and in the long run, that's really not effective either.
Mm-hmm.
So in the work that I do, I give them other tools. Once they recognize the energy of anger, there's something different that they can do to express what needs to be said, because it needs to be addressed. Whatever happened needs to be addressed, or chances are it'll happen again. But to address it in a way that the other person can really hear them and receive what they say.
Mm-hmm.
That might be developing another part of the brain.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Dario Nardi. If you want to know more about Dario, you can go to his website, DarioNardi.com. And we're talking about bringing any emotion and somatic focusing to his brain lab. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Andrea Isaacs, and the show is What We Need to Know. I've been talking with Dario Nardi. He's a neuroscientist. He's an author of many, many books, including 8 Keys to Self-Leadership, From Awareness to Action, and The Neuroscience of Personality. And we're talking about the brain lab that he has in Southern California. And next week, in fact, we are bringing my work, Any Emotion and Somatic Focusing, to the Brain Lab. So, Dario, a lot of people in my workshops ask me this question. They learn a lot of tools for making change. We're talking about anger earlier on. And here's an example. Say, for instance, someone has a short anger fuse and they blow up easily and they yell and scream. And they really come to recognize that it doesn't work. They don't like being that way. They realize how hurtful they've been to the other people in their lives. And so a tool that they've learned from the somatic focusing, and I'll just define that briefly for the listeners who don't know the work. Focusing is based on a psychotherapy technique designed by Eugene Genlin, in which the therapist asks the client, when all that is going on, what's your body's felt sense? How does that feel in your body? And they come up with a term. It's an energy or action word about the body's felt sense. And then the word somatics, it was coined in the 1970s by a man named Thomas Hanna, is a way of using the body, soma meaning body in Greek, using the body in a way to promote wholeness. So in my work with individuals, we take a disturbing emotion, in this case, say anger, and how it feels in the body, getting the body's felt sense. And we get out of the chair, we move in a way that brings that emotion alive, that disturbing emotion alive again. And then in about, I don't know, it takes maybe 2 or 3 minutes, sometimes less, sometimes a little more, but not much more. We do an alchemy and we transform that emotion into an alternative. And the alternative is an energetic state, and they capture it with a word or phrase, which would be a mantra, and with a body position, which would be a mudra, which together really capture an alternative way of being. It's an antidote, say, to this anger. So say, for instance, I work with someone on anger, and they come up with a mantra that has the mudra maybe has their hands on their heart center, and the mantra might be something like, I speak gently from my heart. And so the way they would use that is the next time they feel triggered and their anger is really about to just explode, they, as soon as they recognize that, they only need to say those words quietly in their mind. And in my awareness, and you'll know this technically more than I do, Dario, the brain releases the peptide or the chemical which lands on a nerve cell, which communicates the message of speaking from my heart. It sends that message through all the neural pathways in my body. And every time I do that, that neural pathway gets stronger and stronger. So the question I have that people have asked me that I want to ask you is, and I'll give you my answer to it, and then I want to hear yours, is how long does it take to make real lasting change? You know, there's research that says it's 3 months or it's 27 times. And, you know, people say a lot of things. And sometimes my answer could be, it could be immediate. Because if you have the awareness, as soon as you notice that you're getting angry, you say that mantra, I speak gently from my heart, and you will say what you need to say, but it will come from that place of loving kindness. And you know, motivation and desire to change is the key. Once people have that, once you have an alternative way of being, which I believe this work provides, then the change can be immediate. So that's my take on it, Dario, and I wonder what you see from the brain's perspective in terms of how long it takes, say, to change the brain to really support that change.
Right, right. Well, that really is, I mean, the whole, this is just a fascinating area. And naturally, emotions and change are some of the two biggest topics that people are curious about. I'm familiar. Well, first of all, I want to say that I'm not a psychotherapist or neurotherapist or whatnot, so I don't regularly engage in this kind of activity in the lab in terms of facilitating change. But I have worked with people, and as we know, next week when we'll be working together, going to be looking at, you know, how can we make change last? So when a psychologist sits down next to me and will say, let's do a session, and having colleagues around the United States and in Europe and Australia who also engage in neurotherapy and similar things, what is it that they're finding? So I would say probably the key is, as you said, you need an alternative place to go. Mm-hmm. And that really is essential. So, for example, when I was in Tuscany about a month and a half ago, there were a couple of individuals that we managed to see in the lab. And besides noticing what is their brain activity in their favorite regions, the question was, can we shift their activity to something else? And although we could talk distinctly about emotional reactions, in fact, emotions, behavior, thought patterns, what we focus on in terms of our attention, those are all very tightly interwoven in the brain and really support each other in a variety of ways. So just even to ask the broad question, how long does it take or what can we do in order to make a change? I mean, that was a question we were interested in. And I would say this. If we have an alternate place already present in the brain, a pattern of responses that's there and is modestly developed, it's not our favorite, but it's modestly developed, then yes, in a matter of a few minutes, and we found through a series of 3 reinforcement activities, one that would begin to take the person to this somewhat familiar spot for them, and then a second and a third time to reinforce and to keep them there for the rest of the session, that in fact could be successful. And as you described, it could happen fairly quickly. And I believe that's what we find in something like the Enneagram. that although people sort of want to identify with one or maybe two or three of the types of primary, which I think is perfectly fine, as human beings and just for all of our life experience, we do have experience with most of the types in some kind of context. You know, even if somebody is never, you're going to say, oh, I'm never an eight, you know, I never respond this way, I would be very skeptical, as I'm sure you would, to say, really, never. And, you know, there are certainly times when they are. And so let's find that in the brain and those situations, and sort of can we give them then some kind of activity or anchoring or some other kind of therapeutic process that activates that region. And once we find that, then we can give some reinforcing activities to make that happen. And that's one way to go about it. And I've certainly already seen already that this can happen. And the other alternative, though, is for every person, there is at least one and maybe two or three brain regions that are not just secondary, they're simply neglected. And it's sort of like, it's, you know, we use much more than 10% of our brains, but there probably is 10% that we don't use. I think that's a safe bet. And so if you really want to move a person to a space which is really unfamiliar and sort of neglected for them, then change can take a while. And the folks who talk about habit building, who engage in neurotherapy, yes, it can be anywhere from a minimum of 2 or 3 weeks of just thinking about trying to even go there or making some attempts, all the way up to 2 or 3 months of constant reinforcement. And so the idea is you can't delete existing patterns, but you can leapfrog over them a little bit and you can try and form some new ones or build off of some existing ones. And I would certainly say the techniques that you have been using, this multimodal technique with kinesthetic, with verbal, with visual, and so on, that's very important in terms of learning new habits.
Yeah, it is multimodal, and I think because of that, it uses the brain in a different way, and it gives them an alternative. And so one of the ways I say it in my very layman's type language is that if there's a pattern that is, say it represents a part of the brain that's totally neglected. Like, say someone who's always on the go and very focused and is very impatient with other people. Mm-hmm. So say patience is a part of the brain that's been neglected. Say someone is, you know, just not a patient person and they're very harsh with themselves and therefore also harsh with others. So I believe that to give them to have them find within themselves that neural pathway for patients will engage the brain, and it will engage a neural pathway. It may create one that maybe they did not have the neural pathway to engage that part of the brain, to engage that part of their behavior. So as they discover for themselves what that is coming from inside themselves, they develop the neural pathway, and as they practice it and strengthen and train and strengthen that neural pathway, it will develop that part of the brain that helps support patients.
Yeah, and certainly just the behavior described of being very goal focused and charge either of oneself or others, that very much is the left prefrontal area of the neocortex. The sort of, if you point on your left hand side to your forehead and that region there. When that region is the most active, and I would say this is true for everybody, that either one or the other of our two executives, because we all have two executives, sort of like how Apple Computer was founded by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, how Google and Facebook also, they had a pair of people. And so our brain has two CEOs, and inevitably one is more dominant. And if it's too dominant, if they're not well coordinated with each other, if the person is just always in one space or the other, then that can really feel unbalanced. And that actually is a goal in neurotherapy, for example, is to help folks even out the use of the executive regions. And while that's not something that I do with clients, I understand that there are techniques to help even those out. And that's just talking about the front of the brain, not to mention the rest.
So I'd love to know more about that. What does it look like if someone has the two executive regions that are not evened out? What does that look like?
Well, on the left side.
Not just in terms of the brain, but in terms of behavior.
In terms of behavior, okay. So what we would get with folks who are more, we'll say, goal-focused is the term that I'll use. They could be more extroverted or more introverted, either style. The more extroverted one is going to show up as being very in charge, very much confident, optimistic, maintaining a positive attitude. When criticism and failure come along, they simply filter those out. They don't necessarily manage them, but they might just ignore them and filter them out. They have goals they set for themselves, and they move quickly towards those. Mm-hmm. And I imagine we have not only met some folks like that, but that very much is an ideal in many areas of, say, the business world and just this idea of success in general. What does it take? That side could also show up as in a more introverted way as the person who is very analytical, very noticing of mistakes, especially by other people, but also themselves. Very much trusting in whatever model or set of values, whatever it is that they work towards. If information comes in that contradicts what they believe or how they do things, then they'll just screen out that information. And those folks could be fairly rigid, albeit if they've developed a really good way of doing things, they can be exceptional at what it is that they do. They could be perfectionists. And that's just sort of on the left side. And then as we move to the right side, the more outgoing folks, what does that look like? Well, there's no filter there. So those folks are like, ooh, what is this? And ooh, what is this over here? So very stimulus driven, very open to new information, and taking the information and connecting it to other things, other people in the environment, other people's ideas. Pursuing information all the time. It might appear as a little bit hedonistic or having a short attention span. But they also, too, they can remain positive as long as the stimuli that are coming in are positive. But if negative things come in, they can actually react quite suddenly in a very negative way and so come off as being a little bit moody. And I think that's why those folks generally say, like, oh, I either like my environment positive, my relationship's positive, or, you know, just get away from me. Mm-hmm. And then what's sort of interesting, maybe one of the least common, is sort of the introverted version of that, which is the introspective, reflective, creative person. Like, they still have that big openness to the world, but they're not out there trying to smell every flower and drink every, flavor of wine and every flavor of idea. Rather, they're allowing all these ideas to come in and to coalesce. And they usually engage us in a very quiet way, in a reflective way, and are engaged in creative projects. They're artists, they're innovators, that kind of thing. And they just allow whatever comes up in life to direct their creativity. And those folks, I think, would have a harder time as leaders. But they very much, when they're thought leaders or innovators, many times those are the folks that we might think of. So just those four styles there, just thinking about leadership, but they also, each of them have an emotional component about being, you know, very sort of unconditionally optimistic and positive and ignoring anything that comes in that contradicts it, which means, by the way, that those folks do explode about 1% of the time out of nowhere. Yeah, and then, or you can have, folks who are a little bit more like, say, well, I think most of our listeners know Bill Clinton as a public figure fairly well, and he's known as a very, even people who didn't like him politically, when they met him in person, always felt welcomed and energized, and he was, you know, always enthusiastic. But he also had an affection, for example, for hamburgers, amongst other things. And so whatever stimulus would come along, he would take a keen interest in that. And that, too, has its strengths and its pitfalls. Sure. So the ideal is both in terms of the emotional reactions. And by the way, things like depression and so on are also associated with the right side of the brain. So if too much comes in that's negative, then and we don't screen that out, we don't filter out the criticism or the failures, then the person could be very depressed. That it's not just wanting a balance for, say, practical reasons or leadership, but also for the emotional balance that comes with it.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the two CEOs or the two executive mm-hmm. regions of the brain are the same thing as the right and left hemispheres. Is that right?
Well, the right and left executive regions that are right in the front of the brain, and those a little bit different than the rest of the hemispheres in the brain. People talk about left brain, right brain, and there are legitimate differences between them. In the neuroscience community, we talk about the analytical left side and the holistic right side. Mm-hmm. But people might be surprised to hear that a lot of stuff around imagination and emotions and sociability is in the left hemisphere. And not just the right. Mm-hmm. And similarly, there are things involved in defining and categorizing of words and engaging in strategizing and tactics that those also can be in the right hemisphere, not just in the left. So the brain is a little bit more diverse than maybe we've learned about. But essentially, there are some meaningful differences, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I so well remember the drawing from the right side of the brain, and there's been so much written about, like you were saying, just the more generic, you know, the left side is more analytical, the right side is more creative or intuitive. And it's curious, it's interesting to me that what you just said, that there is imagination is not just the right, it's also in the left, and that there's more crossover than maybe many of us had thought.
Oh, yeah, I really view creativity as something that, I mean, the research studies suggest that certainly the right side of the brain is there to help us break out of a rut. When we're faced with a problem and we just revisit the same solutions over and over again, that's sort of the left brain is taking control and is too strong. And so it's good to switch over to the right. But beyond that, creativity really and imagination really do involve both sides of the brain. And similarly, emotions are supported by and encouraged by both sides of the brain, too.
So, Dario, this is a personal question, if you don't mind. You know so much about the brain and like where you get stuck and where the ruts are in terms of the brain. So if you realize, for instance, that you're kind of stuck in a problem, do you say to yourself, oh, I need to use the left side of my brain now, and then you do an activity that uses a different part of your brain? Do you do that?
Well, I personally, I wouldn't say it's quite so clear as that. I'll give an example, though. As a writer, I have written both fiction and nonfiction, and those require, in a way, different mindsets. That when one writes, fiction, that there needs to be, as I would say, I pick an emotional dynamic. And then I allow my imagination to sort of grow wildly, like a garden. Hmm. But in order for words to end up on the page, they need to pass through that emotional filter that says, yes, this fits the emotional dynamic at one. Because otherwise, you just end up with a random hodgepodge of a story of random ideas.
Hmm.
So when a reader comes along, for the kind of things that I write, which tend to be short stories, they don't notice the usual sort of hard, you know, act one, act two, act three kind of story structures that you might learn in a writing class, because I don't write that way. I write in a very organic way, but they'll still say, boy, you know, the story hangs together really well, and it hangs together well because there's an emotional center to it, that emotional consistency. And it's just, I would say in that case, that's a good example of using both the left and the right side. That I do create a filter. It is a conscious choice that I make. What kind of emotional dynamic do I want in the story? Most of the stuff I write is from a very limited view, third person. So there's a character, but essentially their whole environment and experience is generated by them, by their personality, by their expectations, by their culture, and by their emotional responses. And so I need to get into that character. And so there's sort of an empathizing aspect. And that empathizing actually is very much handled by the left side of the brain, not the right, although both sides are involved. So just to get into and ask, what would it be like to be that person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's tapping different parts of the brain. So I would say, In different areas of my life, I do use my brain in different ways. And I have to be honest, it takes some time as, you know, I sit in the lab and I learn about these things, not just from reading books and other people's research, but seeing it for myself. There's a learning curve. Mm-hmm. And now I do try and apply some of this in my daily life, especially when encountering others, to understand, oh, the person, you know, is probably using this part of their brain right now. Not in sort of like a constantly analytical way, but when it matters, when it's relevant.
Great. Well, we are going to take another short break. I've been talking with Dario Nardi. He's the author of, as you said, both fiction and nonfiction. Some of his nonfiction titles include 8 Keys to Self-Leadership and also The Neuroscience of Personality. And Dario and I are doing a research project bringing any emotion and somatic focusing into his brain lab next week. And hopefully we'll have another radio show telling you the results of our research. Anyway, we have one more segment coming up. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Andrea Isaacs. The show is What We Need to Know, and I've been having a conversation with Dario Nardi. As I mentioned earlier, we're doing a research project bringing any emotion and somatic focusing, the work that I've created, into his brain lab in Southern California, and we want to see how effective this work is in changing the brain. I want to go back to something you said earlier, Dario. You're talking about change and that with three reinforcements, you can keep people in that new place. I'd like you to say that sentence again if you remember it, or at least rethink that out loud with us, and then tell us more about what you mean about making change in the brain.
Right, right. So, yeah, that grew out of a specific experience, and I want to let people know this is not some kind of hard and fast rule at the moment. It's simply a hypothesis based upon some observations so far, that when we find a region of the brain that's a person's, not their favorite, but sort of a secondary space that they can go to, a support space, and we want to shift them there. So, for example, we had somebody come in Italy, and he showed quite a bit of left frontal activity in the brain, which is all very useful in his role, but we really wanted to see, can we move him more to the right hemisphere and to tap some of his more creative problem-solving side? And he did show some activity there over the course of the session. And I said, okay, that's great. So I introduced this this technique, which is sort of like, for folks who are familiar with NLP, this would be something called leading and pacing. And it's essentially giving them a series of activities that start with their favorite area and then lead into less preferred support areas and then finally the unused ones. And we found that with one activity, yes, we could move to get his brain active in the sort of support creative space in the right hemisphere. But then his brain wanted to pop back to where it was most familiar, back in the left front area. Mm-hmm. And like, no, we're not going to allow that to happen. Let's give one more activity. And that one more sort of reinforcement, yeah, it then brought him back to the right, but still there was this tug of war in the brain. So we did a third activity that was then able to not only get his sort of creative problem-solving stuff in the right frontal area active, but to remain there for the rest of the session and to have a lot more balance, actually, in his brain activity. So for another 20, 30 minutes, he's able to have both of those. And these were just, these are problem-solving type of activities, but they were fun problem-solving. Yeah. You use metaphor and brainstorming and so on. And they did not include, they weren't full sensory, which I think would be ideal because the research suggests, not my research per se, but what's out there in the published literature, especially recently, from the summer, is that we used to think long-term memory was all managed by these deeper regions of the brain. And they are. They're helped there.
So, Dario, we have like 2.5 minutes left, and I want to be sure you get to the part about the value of multimodal approach to change. So can you say something about that in like a minute
and
a half?
Yeah, so that's exactly it. Yeah, so that's exactly it. In order to remember something in long-term memory, it needs that experience needs to actually engage the parts of our brain involved with movement.
Movement, yes.
Yes, and not just sensation, but actual movement.
Yes.
And so that is the trick, that when we look at these different regions of the brain, and when I'm trying to shift people from one region to the other, yeah, it's fine to give them like a creative activity or something verbal or whatever it is, but the ideal is actually to get them moving and to do something physical so that the experience then goes from something that's transient to something they actually remember that they're going to practice in the future, that they'll engage in the future. So that's exactly it. Is the brain is so multimodal, and those different emotions, perceptions, behaviors are all tied up with each other. So we need to really actually engage all of those things. And I would say exactly as you've said, if you want to help someone build a new habit, they need to change their thought processes a little bit, which can happen through a verbal statement that they might do. They need to redirect their attention elsewhere and know how to do that. They need to have a physical action that goes with it. Ideally, you engage visual parts of the brain, so there's something to visualize as well, which sounds suspiciously a lot like what you do.
Yes, it does. Thank you for mentioning that. That really excites me, that using movement actually crosses the brain barrier and we can actually make real change. Well, Dario, this is so exciting. And as you know, we'll be in the Brain Lab next week and we'll have a future radio show talking to our listeners about what we have discovered. So thank you so much for being with me today, Dario. I'm so excited about the research project we're embarking on. And for our listeners, we'll keep you posted about our research and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening today.